So it's my great privilege to introduce my dear friend, Dr. Vinod Shah, speaking to us on sacred secular dichotomies and healthcare mission. Vinod was born in 1947. He did his MBBS, MS, and MCH in pediatric surgery from Christian Medical College, Vellore, India. Following that, he's married to Dr. Shalini Shah. They've been blessed with three children. Two of them are working in North America and one in India. And his great passion has been serving God through medical mission. He came to faith initially from a Jain background, and he served initially as a pioneer missionary with the Beal tribe and then medical secretary of the Indian Evangelical Mission from 1977 to 88. And then he went on to the Emmanuel Hospital Association, EHA, where he served for 7 years as medical director, and then for another 8 years as the executive director of EHA, managing hospitals right across the whole of North India. He went from there back to CMC Vellore and set up the Distance Education Center. And if any of you are doing the Diploma in Family Medicine with CMC and ICMDA, you'll be very familiar with that. That was one of the many things Vinod set up whilst he was there. And then after that, he became the CEO of ICMDA. And he did that for 8 years and finished just 2 years ago when I took the baton from him. And he's back in surgery now. He's working as a senior surgeon at St. Thomas's Hospital and Leprosy Center. And Vinod is a very deep thinker, always brings valuable reflection to issues. And it's a real pleasure to hand over to him now. So over to you, Vinod. We're really looking forward to hearing you. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter, for that introduction. Many of these insights have come to me because I come from a Jain background. And before I actually took baptism, I studied Jainism sitting at the feet of a Jain Muni. And this is where the major differences between Eastern cosmology and the Christian theology began to appear to me. And I have been thinking about these now, you know, like for 40 years, but I was able to put it down into neat categories only a few years ago. And so that was just an introduction to what I'm going to say. I'm going to talk to you about three important sacred and secular dichotomies that actually has affected our mission and medical mission greatly, negatively. I'm going to talk to you about the three dichotomies, and I'm going to tell you about how they are interconnected, and then a brief explanation about each dichotomy, and then the consequences of these dichotomies. You know, these seemingly innocent looking dichotomies have produced very severe consequences. And then I want to talk about how God expects us to have dominion over all aspects of life and culture. Not expect us to have dominion, but establish God's dominion. And we as his stewards are supposed to enable that. And then briefly about how all work is holy and how that understanding has helped Protestant North to become extremely rich, and a little bit about integrating the sacred and the secular dichotomies. These are the three dichotomies: the work dichotomy, the body and soul dichotomy, and the earth and heaven dichotomy. These are the three what I think are interconnected. Now, this is a little summary. The work that we do, I'm talking about us Christians, the work that we do, we think church work, mission work, and charity work or non-profit work are very sacred. But we think government work, private work, and for-profit work are less important and maybe even very ordinary or profane. And then when it comes to personhood, we think that the soul is sacred and very important, but we think of the body as something that is of less value. In some cultures, like in my own religion, you know, Jain background, it is supposed to be even profane or dirty. And then in the cosmology realm, the heaven is supposed to be sacred, and the earth or the world, they are supposed to be less sacred. How are they connected? You know, the body goes back to the earth. You know, we die and go back, we become dust. And so it's just part of the earth. On the other hand, the soul goes to heaven. And so the soul is more important and the body is not. The secular work helps us to flourish on earth, but sacred work helps us to go to heaven. So sacred work is more important and secular work is less important. Now, this is the compartment I think even Christians have and even evangelical Christians have. In the Kumbh Mela, you will see extraordinary sights, most of them about austerity and about ascetic practices, about torturing the body. I have many more pictures like this. Some of them are extremely ugly and not really for, public viewing. But these are some examples of how they abuse their body. This man has kept his hand up for 12 years and allowed his nails to grow. And it is now ankylosed and he's worshipped as a saint. And there is the other guy who has buried himself for several months. And, you know, he's also worshipped. But mortification of the body is not simply restricted to other religions. It was part of the Christian culture also. In the 5th century AD, in the Byzantium, mortification of the body was very common. Pillar saints were very common. Here are two pillar saints. There was one particular saint, I forget his name. He was up for 30 odd years, perched up on a pillar, and people used to come from faraway distances to worship him. But you know, it was the time when there was war and famine and poverty and all sorts of problems. But this man of God was perched on top of a pillar. So you wonder, you know, what relevance he had to the culture at that time. People like to blame, dualism is the name of this dichotomy. It was supposed to be Greek and Indian in origin. And then it is usual to blame this man, Descartes, because he said that the mind and the body are two separate things and they are connected to the pineal gland. But I think this dichotomy is as old as sin itself. You know, in Genesis chapter 3, they sinned. And then they knew they were naked physically, but they did not know that they were actually internally naked. You know, they were sinful. They felt shame, but they did not feel guilt. They felt shame about the body, but they did not feel guilt about their soul. So, you know, that sort of dichotomy sort of almost started in Genesis 3. Now, the body is also sacred. Now, that understanding is absolutely counterintuitive. There is no religion in the world that would say that the human body is sacred. And this is what Paul said, that you are the temple of the living God. And this is what Jesus practiced, because I will show you how half of the time he spent healing the body. Four reasons why the body is also sacred. Body was made before the fall, and there was nothing profane that existed, you know, in the Garden of Eden before the fall. God himself took on the human body, took on a human body, actually permanently, and then the whole person was resurrected, which means the whole, the body also was resurrected and glorified. And Paul tells us that the body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. So, you know, we have very good reasons to believe that the body is also sacred. In Acts chapter 17, we remember how Paul was preaching to the Athenians, and they were listening very carefully, and they liked what he was saying. But when he began to talk of the resurrection, they scoffed, because they thought, what a fool this man Paul must be if he thinks that the body has any value and if it should be resurrected. And they rejected what Paul was saying. Another very important reason why the body is sacred is because, and this is again absolutely unique about the Christian faith, there is no God, and I have looked at all the Indian gods and some Greek gods and Roman gods, none of them actually spent time healing sick people, you know. But we have 41 Bible verses about healing the body, 48 verses about casting out demons from the body, and 48 verses about preaching. So you can see how Jesus gave enormous importance to the body, and body and the soul and the whole person actually is sacred. And any kind of division, according to me, is not really helpful at all. Because can you think of dividing God into body, mind, and spirit? Who would dare to dissect God out into three parts? But we are made in the image of God. And if we are made in the image of God, why would you want to dissect man into three parts? You know, man is a person, full stop. And body and the soul are very artificial divisions, arbitrary divisions. And the culture of caring did not develop in ancient cultures, Babylonian, Persian, Greek, Roman, and Indian. When I say culture of caring, I mean a formalized culture of caring. They, I'm sure, looked after their family who were sick, and I'm sure the state looked after the soldiers who were wounded, but hospitals, universities for teaching medicine, you know, that sort of formalization in a culture of caring did not really happen at all. And it only happened after the gospel of Christ. And again, none of the ancient gods or goddesses role modeled healing like Christ did. And religion and healing were often dichotomized in most other faiths. What are the consequences of this dichotomy? You know, even Christians have this dichotomy. Even evangelical Christians have this dichotomy. And because of this dichotomy, what has happened is the view of the body has been degraded. And when the view of the body gets degraded, you know, you have a love-sex dichotomy. Love is for the soul, which is pure and holy, and for your wife. But the sex is for the body, which is dirty, and so it doesn't really matter. And you can have a concubine or a mistress for the for your body. And so that sort of degradation is really talks about the body-soul dichotomy. And then if Christians give up on the sacredness of the body, the body will very soon get completely commodified. Organ trafficking, which is already very huge in many countries, the non-Western countries, abortion and sexual perversions will take root and will become really big issues. And the pursuit of truth in medicine, which has so far been encouraged by a Christian culture in the West, will soon be replaced by a pursuit of commerce. Even research will be dictated by commerce, and it will become commodified, and truth will be the casualty. You know, there was a conference in 1980. The World Council of Churches held that conference in Melbourne, Australia, and that was about Your Kingdom Come. The themes for this conference were poverty, ill health, you know, health issues, and justice issues, all issues relating to the body. Very soon afterwards, they had a conference in Thailand, the Lausanne Committee, and it was about how shall they hear. It was about the sort of soul. So, you know, you can see how the two big Christian organizations, one was majoring on the body and one was majoring on the soul. What wouldn't it have been wonderful if both had majored on both? Even in India, you know, William Carey is supposed to be the pioneer missionary. His passion was for conversion. Dr. John accompanied him to look after William Carey's health, but later on he was caught up by the health issues in the country, and so he became a health-related missionary. And a lot of the medical mission in India was pioneered by women missionary doctors because their certification was not valid in the West. Even though they trained Western women doctors, they were not allowed to practice. And so they came to India. And so the body was mainly looked after by the women missionaries, and the soul was sort of looked after by the men missionaries in India. I joined the Indian Evangelical Mission, and in those days, I was told to major on the soul, even though I was a doctor. He said, yes, you can give out aspirin tablets and all that, but you know, there is not much use in saving healthy bodies if their souls go to hell. So I did that. I majored, even though I ran a small 15-bed hospital, I did spend 2-3 hours a day going to villages and evangelizing and planting churches. But you can see how even in the evangelical world, medical mission was not really up there. The result is, even today, 1.3 billion people in 117 countries account for 22% of the world's population live in poverty. And poverty levels are increasing in many countries because of war and refugees. And then we come to the second dichotomy, the heaven and earth dichotomy. Most Christians feel that we need to escape from the earth and migrate to heaven. A bit like escaping from, you know, third world countries and going off to the West. Rather than engaging with the third world countries and doing something for that country, you want to sort of escape. So this is the escape theology. Why polish brass in a sinking ship? You know, anyway, the earth is going to be destroyed. Let's migrate to heaven. Now, I have 4 reasons why the earth is also good. First of all, the Lord's Prayer, Thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. You know, this is one of the first parts of the prayer, and we haven't seen it. The earth is going to be the place where kingdom of God is going to be established. A Christian witness will suffer if you have this heaven and earth dichotomy. And like Karl Marx said, religion will become the opium of the masses. You know, there is nothing here on earth. You have to only wait for heaven. And so we, our religion and what we preach will become just an opium of the masses, and it'll become like a pie in the sky, and themes like justice, equity, beauty, environment will be forgotten, and our religion will become very ritualistic like it was during Isaiah's time. Now here's C.S. Lewis, just look at what I have underlined. He says, if you read history, you will find that the Christians who did most for the present world were just those who thought most of the next. That means, unless we need to integrate heaven and earth. And communism was a reaction to bad Christian theology. You know, if we had the right theology, it may be that communism may have never happened. And then we want to look at, there is one slide that is missing. Yeah. What are the consequences of neglecting the earthly things? You know, the seven mountains, I don't know if you know about those seven mountains, but they represent a summary of the culture that exists in the world today. It's just a rough division. I'm sure there are more. One division, that one culture that Lawrence Cunningham, who made this, is forgotten, is the health mountain. You know, probably he doesn't think of the body as very important, so he's neglected the health mountain. But I would say there are eight earthly mountains, and if we neglect the earthly mountains, then we will have no dominion over the family, education, government, media, arts, entertainment, business, and health. We will be left only with the heavenly mountain. And so we will not be able to do what God commanded in Genesis 1. In Genesis 1, God told us to exercise rulership over the whole creation. Okay, now we go on to the third dichotomy, which is sacred and secular work dichotomy. We are very familiar with a pastor. You know, when you tell a pastor, I'm going to be a missionary in Africa or somewhere else, in Timbuktu, he will say, come up here, let's pray for this brother. And so you go up and he prays for you. But if you go up and say, I want to start a business, pastor will just say, good luck. You know, he may not even pray for you. He may not definitely call you in the front and pray for your business. Because we are deeply ingrained into thinking of sacred and secular work dichotomy. Usually we blame Eusebius because he introduced two ways of life, you know, the perfect life of the life of contemplation and the permitted life or the life of vocation. I mean, perfect life is the life of vocation, and permitted life is the ordinary life, you know, the worldly life, the homemakers, farmers, laborers, and all that. The priests, nuns, and the monks led a life of vocation, the perfect life. So this division formalized this sort of misunderstanding of work into sacred and secular. And what are the consequences of this dichotomy? We have not been able to establish dominion over the creation. You know, I talked about the seven mountains or the eight mountains, including the health mountain. We have been able to establish dominion only on the religious mountain. Now, dominion requires work, and work happens from Monday to Saturday. And Monday to Saturday is secular, and Sunday is holy. So religious work happens on Sunday. And so we have been climbing the religious mountain, but we have not been climbing the Monday to Saturday mountains, which is the other mountains. This is what Abraham Kuyper, he was the Prime Minister of Netherlands, but he was also a theologian. And he said, our king's dominion must include all of creation. And for that reason, all orders and kingdoms in creation must be saved from the oppression under which they now groan. There is not a square inch in the whole domain of a human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. Now, this is based on Genesis 1, where God wanted us to exercise dominion. Now, these are the same seven mountains of culture. Don't forget to include the health mountain. Just to say that evangelicals always forget the health mountain because for them the body is not so important. In the Lausanne meeting, the first meeting in Lausanne and the second meeting, which was in, I'm not sure where the second meeting was, they had many tracts, but they did not have a health track. Finally, in South Africa, in Cape Town, they had the health track. So evangelicals have been very slow to recognize the importance of the body. These are the mountains. I'll just give you an example. This was part of the British television documentary. The most Christianized city in America, it was one of the lowest ranking cities in the nation in providing the core services, and no one wanted to live in that city. And one of the pastors, Dallas pastor, was asked, why is it that your city ranks so poorly when there is so much religion here? So he said, these things don't concern us. We are spiritual leaders. So you can see how at the very highest level, in one of the most advanced countries in the world, we have this sort of dichotomy. The gospel of salvation versus establishing dominion of the kingdom. Now, many people are keen to save souls, and they will give a lot of money for church planting, and India gets a lot of money for church planting, but if you say you want money to do good works, there'll be less money available for that, because they again believe in the gospel of salvation, but they don't believe in establishing the kingdom of God on earth. I'll give you another example in India. Northeast India, this is Northeast India. Northeast India is 95% Christian, and this is Hindu India, which is about 2% Christian. But when it comes to corruption levels, Northeast India is the same as the Hindu India. Christian India is the same as Hindu India in corruption levels. When you come to Africa, that is North Africa, Arabic Africa, and that is Sub-Saharan Africa, which is Christian, and North Africa is predominantly Arabic. But when it comes to corruption levels, both are the same. And so you have to ask yourself, what has 100 years of Christianization in India and Africa, what has it done in terms of the culture, you know, in terms of establishing the kingdom of God on the lands? And the reason is we have, because of this dichotomy, we have not been able to establish any kind of influence in the everyday life and culture. And what we need to do is we need to get back to this understanding, the Puritan understanding, that all work is holy. It was not only John Calvin, but also Martin Luther, who said all work is holy. Martin Luther especially castigated the Catholic Church. He said, a priest in the Catholic Church, his work is as vocational as a Christian woman who is bringing up children. And so he made it very clear that everyone needs to have a sense of calling. Everyone needs to have a sense of vocation. And so that understanding affected the Protestant North. And that understanding did not affect the Catholic South. With the result, and that understanding affected North America, which is predominantly Protestant, but not Central America and South America, which is predominantly Catholic. With the result that the Protestant countries became extremely wealthy because of this Protestant work ethic, the integration of the sacred and secular. Mind you, this division is now coming back again into the Protestant North, and if it comes back in its full regalia again, you know, you might see poverty, you know, in North America and Northern Europe. Well, I mean, these are some questions I had. Does God call people for skilled labor? The answer is yes. To military work, yes. To politics, yes, God calls people to politics. God calls people to strategic planning and leadership work. And I'll give you examples. He called these two people to skilled work. He called Gideon to military leadership, as well as Deborah and Joshua. He called Mary to motherhood. He called Esther and Nehemiah to politics and nation building. God calls people to every kind of work. There is no secular work. And integration is required. Saint Benedict was the first one who actually properly integrated work and faith. And he said, ora et labora, that means pray and work. And if you read him more in depth, you will find he talked about integration both sequentially and synchronously. That means he prayed in the morning and he prayed in the evening and he worked in between. That is sequential integration. But he also integrated synchronously. While he worked, he prayed. Exactly the same thing, Brother Lawrence, he also integrated faith and work. He is like a patron saint of work faith integration because he used to talk to God while he cooked all the time. He used to be talking away to God, and he used to pray in the morning and pray in the evening. So sequential and synchronous integration. You can read more about him in his book called Practicing the Presence of God. And he says you can find God while peeling potatoes if you peel it to perfection. That is something we can, a very good take-home message for us medical folk. If you do your work well, you'll find God in your work. Yeah, this is practicing the presence of God sequentially and synchronously. And it says he was more united to God in his outward employments than when he left them for his devotion in retirement. That means he enjoyed God more when he was doing it at work than when actually he was in his chapel. Well, you can read more about him. I'd like you to look at the last bullet. When you practice the presence of God in the mundane, it is no longer mundane. It becomes holy. You know, you see patient after patient. Sometimes they have the same problem. All of them have headaches or blood pressure or diabetes, and you're tired. But when you practice the presence of God, this is not mundane work anymore. It can become very holy. Work has eternal consequences. Saints will work, rule, live, and enjoy with God and enjoy God for all eternity. And eschatology of work, the work that we do now, you know, sometimes we think, well, I have preached to maybe 100 people. What good that is when there are so billions of people in the planet. But the work that we do now will be perfected, completed, transfigured, or made glorious, and integrated into the new heaven and earth. In other words, the little that we do, the work that we do, has eternal significance. Because if you understand this, then your work will have great value and you will not suffer from this sacred and secular dichotomy. Your work will have excellence. And I will just have three books for reading. One is Love Thy Body. That has got some elements of what I'm talking to you about. And then N.T. Wright's Surprised by Hope. He has written many books about heaven and earth dichotomy. And then Theology of Work Project, which has got everything that I've been talking to you about. And I just have one question for you for you to think about. Adam and Eve were created on the sixth day, but God asked them to rest on the seventh day. Why did God want them to rest when they're not even tired? They've not even started work. You know, he's asking him to take rest for one day. And so that really is a lesson for us to think about what really the seventh day is all about. The seventh day is not about working out exhaustion. It is about celebrating God. So the Christian understanding of rest is that rest comes first. It predates work. You rest, and from the energy that you get from that celebration with God, you work. You don't work and then you sort of get exhausted and then you go to your God, you know, completely exhausted. That is not the Christian understanding of rest. Christian understanding of rest is night and day, the first day. Night is the rest and day is the work, first day. So with that, I'll stop here. And to summarize, I talked to you about the three dichotomies and their interconnectedness. I explained to you about the details about the dichotomy and the consequences. And I told you how it is important for God to have dominion over all aspects of life. And I believe that one important corrective would be to understand that all work is holy, and to integrate that, and to integrate work and rest. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Vinod. Always such a great pleasure to listen to you. And we've been listening to Dr. Vinod Shah talking about the sacred secular dichotomies and healthcare mission. Now, I wonder, Vinod, first of all, first question is that you mentioned you'd come from a Jain background. And someone is asking, could you just give us a brief overview of your testimony? What made you move from Jainism to Christianity? And particularly how that move shaped your understanding of these dichotomies?
I actually read the Sermon on the Mount, and because Mahatma Gandhi prescribed that all non-Christians must read the Sermon on the Mount. So when I was in Loyola College, it's a Catholic institution, I read the Sermon on the Mount and I then fell in love with Christ, and then I began to read more. It would be wrong to say that I argued my way out of Jainism. No, I just fell in love with Christ and I knew he was God. And then there were lots of challenges with the Jain community. They kidnapped me and kept me locked up for 4 weeks. And then I had to make some decisions to be able to go out of that. One of the decisions was that I would study Jainism for 6 months. And so after I finished my medicine, while everybody was doing internship and pursuing postgraduate education, I was sitting at the feet of a Jain Muni studying Jainism. But you know, that helped me a great deal because it gave me insight into the differences. You cannot understand Christianity unless you compare it with other religions. You can learn things only in comparison. You cannot learn it otherwise. And so, because I was able to compare it, I knew how different and how radical Jainism was. Christianity was. Important reason why I would not never go back to Jainism is because it's an atheistic religion. It is not about love. Relationship is supposed to be bad because relationship is supposed to be something that imprisons you and keeps you enslaved, and you have to be completely detached if you want nirvana. And so that sort of understanding is something I couldn't really cope with. So
thanks very much. Next question from Mark Topazian, who's a healthcare missionary in Ethiopia, I think. Your supervisors advised you to spend your time planting churches, not healing bodies. This remains a common hierarchy of importance for many who are interested in missions, he says. How do you respond to this? Why bother spending time healing bodies that are destined to die when we could save immortal souls? So it's a question really of how you address mission leaders who don't seem to grasp this this distinction.
I think one can specialize in church planting, one can specialize in evangelism, but not because the body is not important. And one can specialize in healing, not because the soul is not or preaching is not important. Both are important, and the church has to look after both. But the problem with mission agencies is they are often closed to good works. It is not true now in India. It used to be true about 20 years ago. They were close to good works and they were only open to church planting. But it is the responsibility of the church to be interested in both and to integrate both.
Thank you. From Hedwin, who you know, Hedwin's works with ICMDA in Southeast Asia. He's asking any practical ideas for ICMDA or ICMDA regions or national bodies about how to address this very common conception, how to avoid the dichotomies.
Yes, I find that in the UK, for example, you can have Christians who are in private practice and they have a sense of vocation and they have a calling. You can have Christian businessmen, or at least there used to be, or there are still many in the US who have a real sense of calling to mission, but they are businessmen. Now, we don't have that in Africa and in India. In Africa and India, we have a dichotomy. Either you are a missionary or you're out. You are a secular guy. So if you're working in a private sector, then you are not a missionary. But we need to recapture the fact that all work is holy. So if a person works in the private sector, if he recaptures a sense of vocation, he will use all the opportunities he has for opportunities for building the kingdom of God, which we do not do at present in many of the developing countries, non-Western countries.
Now, that's a good segue to our next question from Rod McRory, who's a British doctor who's served in South Asia. And he says, in Indian healthcare sector, there seems to be a divide between profit-making hospitals and mission hospitals for the poor. How can we bridge that divide? Should Christian doctors and nurses be witnessing in the secular and private sector. And of course, we've seen, haven't we, that initially a lot of the healthcare was provided through mission hospitals or the big teaching hospitals like Ludhiana and Vellore, but now there's been a real explosion of private care in India. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the private sector is built on profits, the bottom line. And because Christians haven't joined the for-profit hospitals, believing Christians, you know, Christians with a vocation, they have not joined for-profit hospitals, they are becoming worse and worse, and they are becoming more and more centers of profit, less and less caring. I think if many Christians had initially taken the initiative of moving into the private sector would have been a much better place for patients to go to than it is today.
But there's a real challenge for Christian doctors, that the desertion of the private sector by Christians and the failure to be salt and light has actually contributed to its meltdown and decay. Now, anonymous question here. If all work is holy, as you said in your last slide, what about work that Christians might consider immoral, working in a betting shop, running a hospital where abortion services are provided, and so on? Is there good work and bad work, and how does one decide between the two?
Well, I mean, anything that is immoral is not included, obviously, in that. But there is a big chunk that is just secular, you know, like farming or labor work or work of a housewife or lawyers. You know, these things are not, they are thought of as secular. They don't have any sense, people don't have a sense of mission when they're doing it. But if they had a sense of mission, we could have redeemed lawyers' work, we could have redeemed the work in the farming sector, we could have redeemed business, we can redeem so many other kinds of work that the Christians have not moved into. So it's an important thing for Christians to move into every arena and redeem every kind of work. And of course, I'm not talking about prostitution and gambling and stuff like that. Those things are immoral, and we are not talking about redeeming that kind of work. Those things have to be condemned.
Thank you. A question from Mike Sodling, who you'll know, Vinod, a real thinker at this interface of healthcare mission. He's asking, are there Indian authors that you could recommend that have written on this subject? So someone else is asking, have you written a book as well? So maybe you could answer that at the same time, if you've written on this.
I've read many Catholic theologians. The hospitals I go to, St. Thomas Hospital, they have a big library of books, and I've seen some books. But, you know, because Protestants don't read Catholic books and vice versa, I cannot give you the names right away, but maybe I will fish out some books for you, Mike, from Indian authors. A lot of Indian Catholic priests have written about the work theology.
We might be able to get some of those in the letter that we write to you afterwards. Bernard, I wonder if you could, a lot of Christians are under the misconception, I think, that when we die, our soul goes to heaven and our body goes to earth, as you've said. And yet Jesus was resurrected with a body which lit fires on the beach and ate fish and so on. And of course, the New Testament talks about the transformation of the earth. The Old Testament, the new heaven and the new earth. We get the same picture in Revelation. Can you talk a little bit about the new heaven and the new earth and how that should affect or influence our focus in life here and now?
An interesting thing I learned was that heaven was also a created entity. It did not exist before. So it was not as if God lived in heaven from the beginning. Genesis 1 starts off with saying, in the beginning, God created heavens and the earth. And so I think heaven was a created entity. And so it is no surprise that man was expelled from heaven and or from paradise. And then after the resurrection, when he comes again, there'll be a marriage between heaven and earth. I think N.T. Wright has written a lot about this. I don't know too much more about it than, you know, what you have said, Peter.
Now, you mentioned in your recommended books at the end, Nancy Piercy's book on Love Thy Body. And she's an American woman evangelical writer. And if anyone's read that book, you'll know that it touches on the issues of today in the West, things like abortion, euthanasia, sexuality, drugs, and so on. Would you like to just comment on how an incorrect understanding or embracing of the dichotomies can affect the way one thinks and acts about those kinds of issues? You touched on it briefly in your talk, yeah. But what have you got to enlarge on that?
Yeah. There is a serious dichotomy in the West now between the body and the soul. The books about the spirit and meditation and about, self-help books about getting in touch with my inner self and all those sort of things are so popular on one side, and they are obsessed with, you know, the spirit or the soul. And on the other hand, they degrade the body, you know, they don't mind, they accept promiscuity, they accept homosexuality and all other kinds of degradation. So there is a severe dichotomy now in the West, and that is because Christianity has vacated the space that they should have occupied. And because Christians themselves have that dichotomy, they were not being able to help.
Now, just finally, because we're almost out of time, but could you, we know in India, unlike in many countries, in India, there are probably 800 mission hospitals, both Catholic and Protestant. And many of our listeners will come from countries where there isn't a strong healthcare mission tradition. How can the preaching of the gospel and the care for people's bodies be best integrated, and can you point to any best practice models in Indian mission context that demonstrate this well?
Just a comment about mission in India, because missionaries taught Indians that the only two good professions are teaching and medicine or nursing. All of the professions are worldly. Most of the Christians became teachers, nurses, and doctors. And so, because we have such a large body of Christian doctors, nurses, and teachers, in India, we have some control over two mountains. One is the education mountain, and one is the health mountain. You know, every time the government wants a policy, they turn to the Christian medical world. They ask Christian Medical College, Vellore, they ask CMAI. And when they want some help with education, they ask the Catholic institutions about, you know, a new education policy. So in India, we have some control over these two mountains, but we don't have control over the other mountains. But we need to have... you're talking about best practices. I think the new evangelicals in India now are becoming more and more integrated in their understanding. They are beginning to do, you know, integrate good works and preaching and, you know, and creation care and environment and climate change and all that. So I think the newer generation of Christians in India, if their numbers increase, then there will be more integration in this country.
Thank you. And that's a great challenge to finish. I've been interested to see in these COVID times, Christian authors, Christian doctors being published in the Indian national press, lead articles in the Hindu and so on, which have been then picked up by government and integrated into policy. And it's true that there's a huge influence and a huge trust that despite the antagonism of Hinduism towards Christianity, when the Christian doctors speak, politicians really listen. I think that's a great tribute to what you've been talking about. Well, it's been our pleasure, Vinod, to have you here. We've been listening to Vinod Shah speaking on sacred secular dichotomies and healthcare mission. It just remains for me to say again, Vinod, thank you so much for your time and expertise today. Thank you to our translators for all your hard work behind the scenes, for Josh Mills, who manages all the technical stuff and sets this up, and also for all of you who have made the time to come along today and join us on ICMDA webinars. God bless you, and hope to see you next week. Thank you.